And good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690K GGF Kyle High with you this morning. Hope you are having a good day. It's very, very cold out there. Currently around 16 degrees right now. We had a little bit of snow overnight, which actually made the roads not as bad as they had been since the snow gives you a little bit of traction, unlike just driving on straight ice. And joining us this morning, it's time for Greenside Up. We have Wendy Powell and Jesse Gilmore in studio with us this morning. And guys, good morning. How are you doing today?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great.
It's good to see you guys this morning. And Wendy, we'll go over here and start with you here in just a second. But you do have a couple of workshops coming up that people can either attend virtually or maybe in person.
Yeah. So right now, we've got the Evidence of Improvements workshop on the books. That's going to be March 1st in the evening. And that's a virtual opportunity only. We're not doing that one in person at all. But that's going to be Dr. Jamie Lynn Farney and myself visiting about different processes of record keeping. So I've talked in here several times about the importance of record keeping, and then she and I are going to go through some different opportunities that are available online, different systems that can be used, and of course the why we want to keep those production records. So Evidence of Improvement is what we're calling that program, because that's exactly what we use those records for. And then on February 19th, a lunch and learn session, the 16th through the 18th, I'm sorry, K-State Research and Extension, as well as Kansas Department of Ag, is offering a farmers market / direct to consumers virtual workshop. And this is going to be kind of a food safety, value-added products, meat and poultry regulations, sales tax. So anybody working with farmers markets, that opportunity is out there February 19th. So next week for that opportunity. And you can find more information on both of these opportunities on our Facebook page. We do have lots of other opportunities, but those are the two that I wanted to highlight this morning.
All right. So, Wendy, we'll go ahead and get started with you this morning. And one of your topics to talk about will be lice. And, it just kind of gives you chills when you think about it. She's just over there, ugh. it's something you don't want to think about. But I guess our first question for you is, can animals actually get lice?
Yes, they can. It's a little bit of a different variety, if you will, of lice than what we typically see in people. We most commonly think of the little white critter that's in our hair. But with animals, oftentimes it's a brown little critter, a touch bigger than what we've seen in humans. But right now is the time to be talking about this because animals are huddled up. I mean, it's cold out there. And so they're standing close together.
Huddle for warmth.
Yes. So trying to stay warm. And so right now, if they have lice, then they are sharing it.
Yeah, that's it's not something you want to have amongst your animals. And again, you said these lice are different than what people get infected with. Well, how can a producer know if his animals have lice?
Sure. So if an animal is constantly rubbing on a fence or scratching, if you're seeing some fence damage that maybe you didn't notice before, but it doesn't look like it's really been pushed through for an animal to go through to the other side, but just kind of scratching, those are some signs. But also if you're seeing any large hairless patches on the skin where lice would have been eating at, and then that animal is rubbing the hair off to kind of scratch their itches, essentially, that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, because unfortunately for those animals, they can't just sit there and scratch, you know, with their hand, because they don't have a hand. They
That's
only
right.
have hooves, and it'd be kind of hard for them to scratch like a dog, because they'd probably just fall right over. So if you see them hanging out around fence posts, just keep kind of rubbing up against it. They're trying to scratch that itch. They'll be on the lookout for that. Can lice be seen just by the naked eye?
Yes, they can. But oftentimes, like a cow in a pasture, we're not really going to get that close to her to part her hair and find out if there is lice there. So that's where we kind of have to use our judgment. if you do notice some lice damage, then you have to consider the economic threshold there. With Wendy and her family, the economic threshold is one lice. If one lice comes into my house, treatment is called for. However, but with cattle or other livestock, you should look, consider that economic threshold. 10 lice per square inch is what we're talking about there. So if you've got cattle that have 10 lice per square inch, and that's going to include eggs, then that's when you're going to be looking for some treatment options.
So if you see, like, maybe, like you said, you know, if it comes in your house, obviously, and it's just one, treatment for everybody at that point. But if there's just, like, one on the animal that you find, obviously, that's probably not as big of a deal, but it can become a pretty big deal pretty quickly, can it not?
Yes, it can, especially whenever animals are huddled up together the way they are this week and looking like next week, too.
All right. So, you talked about giving treatment. Well, what kind of treatment can we give to those animals that end up having lice on them?
Yeah, there's some options for pour-on formulations and injectables. The I'm not even going to try to say that word right. ivermectin, doramectin, those are some types of things that you're looking for. Those types of treatments, they do internal parasites as well as the lice and ticks. So if you haven't treated those animals yet, you might consider that if we continue to have a cold winter like this. And we're kind of, we say that lice get really bad December through March, but depending on weather, of course. That's what everything revolves around. So if they haven't been treated yet, you might want to go ahead and do that. And then next year, kind of stay on top of that in late November to apply some treatment in before December gets started.
So if an animal gets treated, how long does a treatment last? And also, during this time of year, like, what it's like right now, is this a time where the animals can get lice pretty easily? Because you would think with it being so cold, it would maybe kill them off.
So unfortunately, as the lice burrow down within the hair, they get closer to that animal's skin, and the body temperature of the animal keeps them warm. Mm-hmm. So they're not quite as exposed to the elements as we would like them to be.
Which we wish they were, because then they would just drop off and die.
Yes.
You know.
But treatment, it depends on, of course, which formulation you use and the age of the animal and their exposure. Ideally, our treatment is lasting for the full season. So if you're applying a treatment in late November, we like to see that last through March. But the age of the animal, you know, what else is going on with the animal, if they have other illnesses, other illnesses, sometimes those can be affected.
So how do you treat the non-blood feeding lice? Because there's some that maybe they're just kind of hanging out. They're maybe not feeding on the blood. How do you treat those?
Sure. Yeah. Some of them just feed on the skin and the secretions of the animal. And the other varieties actually are looking for the blood through the skin. But those are going to be topical treatments, kind of like a horn fly control. And it's really effective against adult lice. But treatments that we have right now don't really affect the larva or the eggs. So you have to retreat with the cycle of the lice, which gets to be cumbersome.
And does it help just also with just kind of general hygiene? Does that help keep lice off of your animals? Or is it just going to probably happen at any point, even if they're clean or not?
It's kind of like humans. If lice are exposed, then they're probably going to try to get in there.
Right.
So it doesn't matter how clean your hair is. Unfortunately, lice are going to try to set up shop if they're exposed.
And do you have any tips on applying these treatments? Like you said, there's topical, but there's also other treatments. What are some tips on applying these treatments?
Yeah. So whenever we're talking about those topical applications, you want to go down the full top line of the animal and not just get up there by the shoulders. You want to go all the way down from pole to tailhead, and then that will expose that whole animal to the treatment so that thorough coverage there is the goal. And then that also kills lice by contact. So with those non-blood feeding lice, then we want to make for sure that you follow the label instructions to get that applied. Basic biosecurity is another way to have some prevention if you've got new animals coming into your herd. Quarantine, word of the decade,
yes,
probably.
Yeah.
So quarantine new animals, that's going to reduce the risk of lice, but as well as a lot of other diseases as well. So keeping new animals separated before they enter the herd will ensure some biosecurity.
And those can affect, like you said, cow, but can it also affect other types of like horses or maybe other kinds of livestock? Can it affect those as well?
Yes.
So that's definitely not a good thing. And also, like you said, this lice is different than what humans can, but can it, could they actually jump onto humans as well?
Yes. I'll tell you a short little story. My mom and brother and I were trimming some feet on a horse, and I was holding his head, and all of a sudden I was like, Bub, you've got to take this horse. My hair is going crazy here. And sure enough, that horse had lice, and they had jumped from the horse's head over to my hair.
Oh.
And that was the most awful experience.
Oh, man. I had it once when I was a small kid, and the way my parents were able to work on it was just they just shaved my hair completely off. That way, one, if anything was in the hair, it went with it.
Mm-hmm.
But two, if there was still anything else up there, they could
fight.
Actually, well, what they would do, they would get like the pincers or something like that and get it and grab it. But I don't think there was anything there. It's just they noticed like a few in my hair at the time. And I was like, my parents told me I was like 6 or 7 years old. So so that's the, you know, that's the time when, you know, kids are all together and it doesn't matter. Everybody's all together and everybody starts sharing everything, apparently. So
mm-hmm.
because
yep.
you don't care, you're rolling around on the ground. And that's probably how I got it, to tell you the truth. It was probably rolling around on the ground or something like that and hanging out with kids as well. All right, so again, lots of different ways to look for lice. We'll find out a little more later as well. So Wendy, thank you so much for that today. And we're going to come over here to Jesse. Jesse, we don't have too much time left in this segment, but today you're going to be talking about tomatoes.
Yes. So tomatoes are the most popular garden vegetable grown in the United States.
And are delicious.
I don't quite agree.
On a burger. I like them on a burger. There we go.
I mean, I would personally never grow tomatoes, but that's more of a taste thing than
right,
how they
right.
produce. They produce.
No, they produce really well.
Really well down here. And it's about time for home gardeners to start germinating their seeds so that they can have transplants in time to get them into their garden in the late spring and early summer. And when looking through seed catalogs, there are typically a couple of terms that can kind of trip people up on what they should order. And the first one that we're going to talk about before the break is determinate versus indeterminate cultivars. This describes the general growth habit of tomatoes in the garden. Determinate means that it grows to a certain height and then puts all of its energy into fruit production. It does not get any taller than that particular height. You only get one harvest out of these plants during the season. Typically, they're going to be favored by commercial producers because they all ripen pretty consistently in terms of time. So you cut them all at the same time and then take the plants out. And if you have started a new generation of seeds, you can get those into the ground. And that's how you would get multiple harvests in a particular growing season.
So timing wise, they're pretty reliable on their timing. So that way you can kind of figure out when to plant it and how long it's going to take to grow.
Yep. One of the other benefits of determinate growth tomatoes for commercial producers is that they have bigger individual fruit because they only grow to a certain point vegetatively and then they sink all of the extra energy into reproductive growth, which means that their fruits will be bigger, typically sweeter, in order to, because they have that longer maturation period. That's how you pronounce that word. But they also have a couple of cons. That particular height and only getting one harvest out of a particular plant means that they're not as popular with home gardeners. Because home gardeners like to be able to come throughout the growing season and get tomatoes whenever. So for home gardeners, indeterminates are going to be probably the better choice. You get multiple harvests out of them during the growing season. They grow taller, which means that in a lot of cases, they're going to need some kind of support like cages or stakes. They also end up with more fruit and greater total production, even though each individual fruit is going to be less or smaller than any determinant variety's fruit will be. The fact that they grow taller means that they can put more flowers out, and once they're pollinated, get more fruit. It is important to know, though, that the potential yield of indeterminates throughout the growing season can be limited if the temperature gets too hot. If it's over 70 degrees at night or 95 degrees during the day, that can inhibit pollination of all tomatoes. And I've gotten a couple of questions about why tomatoes don't put out enough fruit. Our particularly hot June last year would be why, is because the pollen becomes unviable at really high temperatures. So indeterminate could be problematic if we get super hot temperatures, but still, for the average home gardener, indeterminate is going to be better. And there is also the potential for semi-determinate, which has a mixture of both qualities. And semi-determinate or indeterminate are going to be probably about 75% of the seeds that are available to the home gardener.
All right. So, and we'll talk more about tomatoes after the break. You're listening to Wendy Powell and Jesse Gilmore here on Green Side Up here this morning on the Mighty 690 KGGF. We're going to go ahead and take our break here at the top of the hour, and then we will get back to Green Side Up starting at around 8:10. So keep it locked here on the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day morning in southeast Kansas and northeast Oklahoma. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Open Line. The off-air topic can be fun as well. Let's talk about it. I don't like strawberries. Just the texture bothers me. So that's what we've been we were talking about before we came back on air. But it's back to Green Side Up for you this morning here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Again, we hope you are having a good day and staying warm outside. Currently outside, our temperature is 18 degrees. We'll get up to a high of about 23, so it's not going to get much warmer today. And we will welcome back to studio with us this morning. We have Wendy Powell and Jesse Gilmore. And guys, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, if you have any questions for us today, we'll get back to Jesse here. He's going to has more to talk about tomatoes. But if you have any questions about any subject that's been brought up today, give us a call. Our numbers are 251-6909, 1-800-252-5443, 1-800-252-KGGF. If you have any questions about what Jesse's talked about, he's talked about tomatoes this morning. Also, Wendy's talked about lice this morning, and she will talk about some workshops here a little bit later on as well, if you missed the first part of the program. And let's get back to Jesse here. And Jesse, we got some more stuff about tomatoes. You've been talking about determinant, indeterminate, also semi-determinant, but there's some other things you would like to talk about on tomatoes this morning.
Yes. So a couple weeks ago, I talked about the difference between open pollinated and hybrid seed. I'm just going to go over that really briefly as kind of a review, because that's going to play into some of the data I have coming up on tomato trials that we've just completed at the Pear Horticulture Center in Hayesville. So open pollinated varieties, these are also known as heirloom varieties. They're created through traditional breeding. So sexual reproduction of the tomato, cross-pollination, you have genes that are passed between plants. A lot of times these are going to be true to type, and seeds that you get out of these plants are going to be very similar and have a lot of the same characteristics as the parent plants. Hybrid seeds, on the other hand, are going to not be true to type because of the way they are genetically bred. That does not include cross-pollination. Typically, they're going to be self-sterile, or they're going to be of a much lesser quality in future generations. So those two groups of seeds are very important to keep in mind when selecting varieties, and each has their own pros and cons. Hybrid seeds are going to have much greater disease resistance than open pollinated or heirloom varieties. So down here in southeastern Kansas, we get a lot of rain. We got a lot of rain last year, and we got even more rain the year before. And wet conditions or humid conditions or both precipitate a lot of disease. And particularly in tomatoes, you see things like early blight, which can really cripple your tomato yields if it gets to the plants early. So that is one thing to keep in mind when considering whether or not to buy open pollinated or hybrid seed. Open pollinated tomatoes also tend to be a lot softer and more prone to damage if you need to transport them. That's not really going to apply to the home gardener, but if there are any people who are interested in commercial production of tomatoes and need to ship the tomatoes to a distributor or a basically end consumer, that is another thing to keep in mind. Hybrids will also typically be smaller vined than open pollinated varieties. So if you, before the break, we talked about determinate versus indeterminate. If you went with hybrid indeterminate plants, they're typically going to be smaller than heirloom indeterminate plants. But we just got done with a tomato trial at the Pear Horticulture Center. They basically took all of these different varieties, both hybrid and open pollinated, and compared the pounds per plant of total tomatoes and also the average weight of the fruit that came from the tomatoes. And they listed out the best varieties for the general Kansas climate. In terms of pounds per plant, the top three or all heirloom varieties. German Johnson was third at 17.2 pounds per plant. Cherokee Purple, one of the most popular heirloom varieties and honestly my favorite heirloom variety. I know I said I hated tomatoes earlier, but Cherokee Purple is a beefsteak tomato, so more flesh, less juice, 17.6 pounds per plant. And then Anna Russian was the top producer in terms of total fruit per plant at 21 pounds, which is quite significant if you are a home gardener with limited space to grow tomatoes. And then for ounces per fruit, you have Brimmer Pink at 11.2 ounces per fruit. You have Beefmaster at 11.62 ounces per fruit. And then Amana Orange at 12.11 ounces per fruit. Or 3/4 of a pound per fruit, which is a rather significant sized tomato. Amana Orange and Brimmer Pink are both heirlooms, and Beefmaster is a hybrid. Overall, if you want to go with hybrid tomatoes for their disease resistance, Beefmaster is definitely going to be the best choice. It ranked number 2 in the average weight per fruit at 11.62 ounces per fruit, and it also came in 4th in terms of pounds per plant. So it is the best producing hybrid overall for our area, and that would be the one to look for if you're looking for hybrid seed.
And also, one thing I did want to ask you is that, and I asked you this off air, that always confused me as a kid, that why are tomatoes classified as fruit instead of vegetable? Because it just seems like it would be a vegetable just because it grows out of the ground. But again, there are differences why it's considered a fruit instead of a vegetable, right?
Oh, boy. Okay. So there are typically three different ways to categorize a fruit or a vegetable. The first is culinarily. And this is typically what people think of when they think of fruit and vegetables. Is it savory or is it sweet? If it's more used in savory dishes, oftentimes it's going to be considered a vegetable, even though it's corn and tomatoes, zucchini. Basically, a lot of the things that we think of as vegetables from how we eat them mm-hmm. are botanically fruits. Botanically, a fruit is anything involved in the reproductive cycle of the plant that allows it in to basically grow seeds and distribute them for passing on its genes. A lot of times it will be a result of flower pollination. So wherever you see flowers, basically if a food product comes from that flower, it's going to be a fruit. Now, you can get into very technical definitions of what a fruit is, because if you think of a strawberry, the strawberry itself is not the fruit. Each individual seed on the strawberry is a fruit.
Ah,
so
there we go.
Basically, you're getting a lot of fruit on a strawberry. And that's going really deep into botanical definitions, and that's not really useful for the home gardener in general. Just as long as you are getting the fruit side of it, you don't need to know specifically what a fruit or a vegetable is. But then there's the third definition, which is useful for home gardeners, of how it's grown. Typically, when we talk fruit, even if it's botanically a fruit, if it's grown in an annual growing season and then dies off, we'll typically consider it a vegetable, even if it is botanically a fruit. So eggplant, corn, tomatoes, melons. Melons are one of the other things that is considered a vegetable for growing purposes. A lot of times, in academia anyway, you'll see melons grouped with other vegetables for growing purposes. And in the Kansas Garden Guide, which is the definitive publication for growing vegetables, melons are included, which can confuse people sometimes. But that's because they're an annual vine, and you typically have to replant them next year if you want to keep getting melons out of your garden.
All right. So if you have any questions for Jesse or Wendy here, we're going to come back to Wendy here in just a second. Our numbers are 251-6909, 1-800-252-5443, 1-800-252-KGGF. Come back to you, Wendy, and somebody missed the first part of the program, but so we'll just kind of take some quick hitters from what you were talking about today. You were talking about lice, and like you said, this time of year, animals can get lice because they're kind of huddled up for warmth, try to keep themselves warm. Again, you said these lice are not the same kind of lice that we get infected with. It's kind of a different one. So if a producer is wondering if their animals have lice, how can they find out if they do, just by, just without, actually just searching the animal? What are kind of some things that a producer needs to look out for?
Sure. So a lot of times producers will see shorter hair. Oftentimes in the winter, we hope that animals have a longer hair coat. So whenever that hair becomes short in small patches, that's a sign of lice. And then also if you're seeing animals that are scratching on fence posts or structures, they're trying to scratch their itches. So if you're seeing fence posts that are leaning, that wouldn't typically lean, but they're not all the way over, of course, for animals to be exiting a pasture, then
that's a whole nother problem right at that point.
Yes. Yes. So look for those patches of hair that's missing, and then also the animals scratching.
And also, lice can be kind of seen once you finally start going through the animal somewhat. But if even just one is seen, should treatment be started?
I would caution folks to make for sure that there's about 10 per square inch. Unless you just have a really low threshold for lice, like I do in my house. But with animals, 10 per square inch is our economic threshold there.
Okay, and also because, they can also lay their eggs as well, which then crops up a whole bunch of them at that point. That's not a good thing as well. So how do you, there's several ways to treat lice. What are the ways to treat lice? There's several different ways to do it.
Yeah, we've got some pour-ons, but there's also injectables. So when you're using those pour-ons, just make for sure that you're going from the pole of the animal all the way to the tail head for a thorough coverage. And for those injectables, make sure you're following all of the instructions on the label and make for sure that those products are going to cover lice. And oftentimes, products that cover lice are also going to cover ticks as well.
So that'll help out with ticks being an issue, as ticks and fleas can be an issue as well. And one more question about this, and then we'll start talking about, you got some workshops coming up. So if you were to, when you start a treatment, what's the best time to start the treatment? Is there a certain season to start the treatment, or just basically when you find lice on your animal? But are there seasons, best time to start applying these treatments?
Yeah, so we are seeing lice between December and March is when our terrible season really is, because that's when it's cold and animals are huddling up for warmth. So application of treatment in late November is called for, and so you can just kind of get a jump on that.
All right, so be sure to do that, and if you see them scratching up against a post, may want to take a look at that area. Something's bothering them there. Well, Wendy, you guys have some workshops coming up, and when are those starting, and what are those, and how can they be attended?
Sure. So on March 1st, we're doing a project called Evidence of Improvement. Dr. Jamie Lynn Farney and I are going to talk about different ways of keeping production records. And we're going to discuss some different systems and, of course, the why we want to use those production records. And we're calling this evidence of improvement because that's exactly what we use those records for, is to show improvement in our operations over time. That'll be March 1st, and it's in the evening. Information for that program can be found on our website or by calling any of our extension offices. The Altamont office is 620-784-5337. And the other workshop I wanted to mention is the Farmers Market Direct to Consumers program coming up February 16th, so that's next week. And that's going to talk a lot about sales tax and the fundamentals of participating in a farmers market or in sales direct to consumers. So that'll be a really good program, thorough, with the K-State Research and Extension partnering with Kansas Department of Ag.
All right, sounds good. And Jesse, you're over there, kind of raised your hand. Sounds like another topic you should kind of want to bring up very shortly.
Well, I just wanted to bring up that the horticulture program at K-State has determined its schedule for the K-State Garden Hour for 2021. We started this program last year kind of out of necessity because of, you know, COVID. Mm-hmm. We wanted to get some classes out to the general public available all over the state. And we are actually starting the 2021 series with planning your vegetable garden next Wednesday from noon to 1. Online registration can happen at hnr.ksu.edu/extension. There's an option to select the K-State Garden Hour over on the sidebar, and then there's a link to register for the classes that you want. The first one is next Wednesday, followed by one on Wednesday, March 3rd for best plants in a beginner's garden. And then every 2 weeks up until, when is it? September 15th, it'll be every 2 weeks, and then after that we'll have one a month.
Okay.
And hopefully we'll be doing this again in 2022, but I will be announcing those classes on future KGGF sessions as they become available. But the one that is immediate will be on planning your vegetable garden. So if you want to get a head start on being able to, you know, get a lot of produce out of your landscape, that would be one to attend on Wednesday, February 17th from noon to 1.
All right. Well, good stuff there. Be sure to pay attention for that. And like Jason said, when new programs pop up, he'll let us know right here on Green Side Up. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming in today. It's always a pleasure to have you guys in. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have Gary and Charles Skank with Skank Insurance with their new midweek show. And that'll be airing here in just a few minutes right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF.
Roman Chevrolet Buick has the largest selection of used vehicles in Southeast Kansas. Prices start at under $5,000. There's financing for everyone at Roman's, along with local and nationwide delivery. The number one dealer in Southeast Kansas is Roman Chevrolet Buick in Independence.